Good morning or good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to CSIS. In case you don't know me, I'm the director of the New European Democracies Project here at the Centre. And I'm just going to say a very few words of introduction before handing over to our moderator for today, Bill Siefkin. Now, let me just say this. I think the focus of global attention in terms of the economic engine of growth has been on energy, usable energy, especially the energy security of the most developed economies. And energy has become highly charged because of several factors, obviously. International dependence on hydrocarbons, the manipulation of supply transit and pricing by certain powers, and the impact, of course, on global warming and climate change. So energy has become a security priority, and this is to be expected. However, no less important is the extraction, procurement, and supply of strategic minerals from A to zinc, commodities that have had much less publicity and focus in recent years. We're trying to redress the balance at least a little bit in our humble way today, and hopefully it may lead to some bigger projects and more initiatives. We'd like to focus on the crucial importance of the supply of strategic minerals for modern economies, particularly for the United States, and how it impacts on transatlantic security. Ultimately, we'd like to come up with some suggestions or some recommendations how we can offer some ideas for improving our security strategy for the wheels of industry in terms of ensuring the supply of strategic minerals. So anyway, I'm a newcomer to this area, so I hope I learn a lot from our guest today. So let me hand it over to Bill.
Thank you, Janusz. I'm sort of like Janusz. I'm looking forward to hearing our speakers today because this is not an area that I've been particularly familiar with. I spent some time in the private sector doing the advanced working on weapon systems. Well, not working on weapon systems, but working at Lockheed Martin Corporation and some of the other major defense contractors, which are extremely dependent on a lot of these raw earths and other strategic materials to produce both the electronics and the platforms that we use in our national defense industry. So it is my pleasure first to introduce our speakers. Our first speaker will be Mr. Roman Kupchinski. He's a partner with the AZ East Group. Became editor of the Radio Free Europe's Crime, Corruption, and Terrorism Watch in November 2001, a weekly news publication that covers trends and activities that have emerged in the post-communist world, which constitute a real danger to our democracies and worldwide. Prior to this assignment, Mr. Kupchinski was director of Radio Free Europe's Radio Liberties Ukraine broadcast service since 1991. He graduated with a BA in political science from Long Island University in Brooklyn and served in the U.S. Army from 1966 through 1969. Most of us who deal with Russia are readily acquainted with Mr. Kupchinski and his expertise, so we'll start off with him. Roman?
Thank you very much. My printer at home has very bad penmanship, so you have to make allowances for this a bit. I have to join Janusz and Bill in saying that I'm also looking forward to hearing a lot about strategic minerals. It's usually something I'm sort of on the edges of. I was more involved in what Janusz was saying on energy security. It was something that I had sort of specialized in for quite a bit of time. And when I was asked to speak at this roundtable, I began reading up on this whole topic, and Janusz is right. It's been off the radar. It is extremely important, and I hope that CSIS will take the lead in trying to revive this whole debate, maybe not even a debate, just a discussion initially on what are we facing, where are we right now, and what the future will hold. There is no question that the supply of strategic minerals is vital to the national security interests of the United States and its allies. Their use, as Bill just mentioned, in numerous weapon systems, aircraft, and technology is critical. This has been the case for decades, but it's taken on a new urgency in the past few years as competition for these rare resources has increased. And nations have instituted policies of resource nationalism, not only in hydrocarbons, but in mineral resources. There's a short list of strategic minerals, the ones most used in defense technologies: chromium, cobalt, manganese, and platinum. All are considered vital to the U.S. national security effort, and all of which are not found in the United States in any significant amount. Today, the U.S. consumes over 1 million tons of these mineral groups yearly. And while there are substitutes for oil, there are no substitutes thus far for these minerals. In addition to this, China today has staked its claim to these precious resources and has joined Russia in a race to gain control over the production and export of these and other minerals in Africa. Will they succeed? Will they force the United States to be left in the unenviable position of being dependent upon Putin's Russia and a resurgent China for its critical mineral needs? Southern Africa, and to a lesser extent Russia, hold the highest reserves of the most important strategic minerals. They account for 88% of chromium, 63% of cobalt, 91% of magnesium, and 99% of platinum. In the race for access to these minerals, we are faced with serious geopolitical questions. Our degree of vulnerability is governed by, among other factors, the political and economic threats facing producing states. Some U.S. defense analysts have stated that today our vulnerability in the strategic mineral sector is higher than it was during the Cold War. Regional conflicts in Africa and internal collapse in producing countries pose significant threats to scarce supplies. Along with the entry of China and Russia into the African mineral sector, unlike Russia, there are no alternative suppliers to strategic minerals. There is no Nabucco-type mining operation which can bypass the traditional suppliers. It should also be noted that during the Korean War and the Berlin blockade, the USSR cut off supplies of its strategic minerals. This was something akin to the gas cutoff to Europe in January of this year. The USSR also used surrogate African states to block such sales when it deemed it important to further their foreign policy goals. Can this be repeated? If so, at what cost to U.S. national security? Now, let's cut to the chase here. Southern Africa is and will continue to be the new geopolitical battleground for strategic materials for decades to come. This is in some ways comparable to the competition for Caspian and Central Asian oil and gas between the West, Russia, and China. But unlike these regions, Southern Africa is the Saudi Arabia of strategic minerals. Some believe that it has already become the great Chinese takeout and that Putin's Africa Corps has made significant political and commercial inroads in the continent. Let's take Zimbabwe, for example. Ruled by 84-year-old dictator Robert Mugabe, Zimbabwe is endowed with rich resources of gold, asbestos, chrome, coal, platinum, nickel, and copper. Mugabe has apparently thrown in his lot with China to some degree. This has placed his country on center stage in the minerals war between China, the UK, and the U.S. Mugabe has been quietly doing business with China, which is virtually unlimited need of strategic raw materials Zimbabwe can produce. Zimbabwe and Sudan are both key players in the war over control of Africa's strategic minerals, between Washington and Beijing, with Moscow playing a supporting role in the drama. In January this year, the British newspaper The Telegraph reported, sitting on the world's second largest reserves of crude oil, the Islamic Republic is now said by Zimbabwean officials to be offering long-term fuel supplies in return for exclusive rights to mine some strategic minerals in Zimbabwe. After Russia joined China in blocking a British and U.S.-sponsored U.N. resolution imposing sanctions on Zimbabwe in July 2008, Mugabe began viewing Russia as a potential strategic partner in warding off a collapse of his government in exchange for mining deals for strategic minerals. During the 1990s, trade between China and Africa grew by 700%, doubling from 2002 to 2003, and in 2005, doubled again. Beijing regards South Africa as the continent's mineralogical treasure house. South Africa contains 87% of the world's platinum reserves, 80% of magnesium ore, 72% of the chrome ore, and 27% of vanadium. South Africa also accounts for 75% of world ferrochrome, and China now imports over 90% of the ferrochrome consumed by its stainless steel industry. I could go on and on with statistics about China's consumption of minerals and how it has dramatically increased. But the question is, and I don't want to go on much longer, the basic question is, how threatening are these developments for U.S. national security? What can be done to peacefully resolve a coming strategic minerals crisis before it spins out of control? Or has it already spun out of control and we don't know it? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ronan. It's very easy, I think, for us to realize, you know, the connections of oil and gas, because we use gas and we use oil, et cetera. When you talk about vanadium or chromium or manganese or cobalt, it's very difficult for the average American to make that connection between a jet fighter or a flat panel display and some raw materials in South Africa. But I guarantee you that you can't build modern technology, modern electronics, modern defense systems without them. It's an absolute necessity. I think we'll proceed with our other speakers before we actually sit down and have the questions and discussion. Our next speaker is Dr. David Minzi, Chief of the International Minerals Section, Minerals Information Team at the U.S. Geological Survey. He received his Ph.D. in geology from the Pennsylvania State University in 1977. His professional memberships include the Society for Economic Geology, the World Mining Congress, the Society for Mineral Metallurgy and Exploration. And he has a forthcoming book dealing with the quantitative mineral resource assessments, an integrated approach. So I understand that you have a presentation. So I'll ask our senator here to move over a little bit and stand by for his presentation. Thank you. So there's a lot of food for thought in those slides. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions when we come back to them. Our next speaker is Dr. Kent Butts, Professor of Political Military Strategy and the Director of the National Security Issues Group at the Center for Strategic Leadership of the United States War College. He heads the Center's Combatant Command Support Efforts, focusing extensively on emerging national security issues. His prior positions include Research Professor in the Strategic Studies Institute of the Army War College, Associate Professor, Science Research Laboratory, U.S. Military Academy at West Point, U.S. Defense and Army Attaché and Security Assistance Officer, in Uganda, Tanzania, and Malawi. I understand you also, he is the author or editor of numerous national security publications and co-author of the book Geopolitics of Southern Africa, South Africa as a Regional Superpower, published by the Westview Press. Dr. Butts, I understand you also have a slideshow presentation. So we will again move.
I apologize. The projector's not functioning, and we can't go to slideshow, so the slides may be a little bit smaller. When they go to slideshow, it's dark and illegible. But what I want to do today is touch on some of the security dimensions of strategic and critical materials and offer some insights in particular on China and its view of this, some would characterize it as resource competition. And let me just go ahead and begin, please. The way to think, I believe, of materials is in terms of geopolitics. Countries that have access to the resources they need can build a robust economy and meet the needs of their people. When they are no longer self-sufficient and they have to import materials, they become vulnerable. China, for example, is quite vulnerable at this point to cutoff of energy and other strategic materials. So too is the United States. So resource geopolitics is something that doesn't drive things the way that they once did, where you had Japan and Germany trying to expand their borders and gain physical access to the materials. Now we trade for them on the world market, and since the end of the World War, the Cold War, there's been an emphasis on trusting the free market to supply the needs. Next slide, please. But it's important to remember historically how critical these materials have been to the continuation of regimes. Turkish chromium, this famous quote by Albert Speer, and it's cut off. Just to drive this back to the traditional security dimensions of the military. Next slide. Some key concepts to bear in mind as you look at the strategic minerals discussions and debate. Resources are not, they become. Resources are anything that satisfy the needs of humankind. The culture is dynamic, and it will change. Economics and technology tend to be drivers of that change. Example might be that whale oil was considered essential around the turn of the century. Now we don't care. We've developed petroleum and ways to exploit petroleum. Could be that in the future, either the economics of petroleum exploration and consumption and production will change, and we'll be forced or encouraged to develop new technologies for energy that will mitigate that dependence. So, too, you've had the argon-oxygen decarbonization process come online that allowed the world to use a different form of chromite. Instead of the low-carbon chromite preferred in the ferroalloys industry, which was narrowly limited to Russia, Turkey, Zimbabwe, around 1972 or 3, Union Carbide developed the argon-oxygen decarburization process that allowed the makers of ferrochromium to use high-carbon or charged chrome, which was widely available in southern Africa, in massive lateritic deposits that are with seams as tall as 2 meters. So the economic changed, the economics and technology changed quite drastically the dependence for this critical and strategic material. Imbalance of supply and demand, pretty obvious, but the concentration, as Dr. Menzi mentioned, of the materials in limited locations around the world complicate this greatly and give quite a bit of leverage to the producing countries. Next slide, please. Okay, historically, alloys were important. If you lived in a bronze weapons age, then access to tin was terribly important. A lot of tin, you could make weapons for a larger army. Without it, you were limited in what you could produce on the battlefield. Malthusian constraints were overcome by access to colonial empires in the New World. Bernard Baruch and Charles Lath were focused on overseas supplies when looking at minerals policy. We could develop domestic resources. We could do that by encouraging them with tax breaks and the like, or we could go with a low-cost supplier. Even in times of war, the United States policy has tended to emphasize the low-cost providers and risk vulnerability to supply cutoff overseas. Paley Commission report of 1952 we'll touch on a bit. And in particular, the Soviets have been very aggressive in its use of resource access, most recently in their natural gas supplies going into Europe. But in the past, strategic minerals were cut off at critical times for the United States, which made us focus much more heavily on access. In fact, the Soviet Union bought up a 2-year supply of cobalt just before the invasion of Shaba province by Angolan forces. Soviet Union was backing Angolan government at the time, which drove the price of cobalt from $6 a pound on the world market to over $50 a pound overnight. So this sort of thing is useful to consider when you think now that China is becoming more of a player. And if you look at the very bottom bullet, market dependence has been the U.S. chosen approach since the end of the world, the Cold War. We will simply purchase it if we have to pay a higher price on the world market. We can assure that it'll be there because a higher price will simply encourage people to go out and find new deposits and bring them online. Next slide. So I thought it's also instructive as we look at China's massive consumption now to look at this quote from the Paley Commission era of 51, the President's Material Policy Commission. We talk now about how China would need four or five worlds to supply the resources necessary for them to meet the needs for affluence on the part of their population. The United States has quite a bit of experience in overconsumption. Still we do. Next slide. So the Paley Commission report was focused on, its recommendations were, we want to seek an adequate and dependable flow of materials at the lowest costs, lowest costs. And that should be foremost in your mind today when you look at materials and strategic minerals to see whether or not the United States or its allies, we're thinking transatlantic at this point, will have what they need to meet their economic and defense needs. Next slide. To give you something of a visual, this came from the private sector back in 1982-83 when it was trying to encourage the United States to pay more attention to the state of our ferroalloys industry, which pretty much is in bankruptcy now. We used to have 11 ferroalloy producers, McAlloy being the last remaining producer. It's in bankruptcy, and I believe in Marietta, Ohio, we have one producer that's still limping along. Not a small consideration given the fact that we stockpile ores based on the availability of domestic manufacturing capability. If it is gone, then you have to ship those stockpiled goods overseas to be promoted into downstream and more valuable products. Next slide. This came from Richard Nixon's book. Give you an idea that not that we need to think of the Chinese as peer competitors or a Cold War enemy, but the Chinese go to school on history. They're very much aware of what the Paley Commission report said and Brooks Emony's book and many other excellent products, to include our own studies that have been done recently. Next slide, please. So we need to be aware of the geopolitical implications in our own economic situation of a concentration of minerals. It could be petroleum, next slide, or it could be the industrial materials that are so important to our economy, not just the defense sector. Next slide. So today, choke points are much more important. GAO report two or three years ago now, pointed out that our strategic petroleum reserve could handle any cutoff or any reasonable scenario with the exception of the loss of the 10 million barrels a day that come out of the Persian Gulf from Saudi Arabia or the 17 million barrels a day that flow out of the Persian Gulf from all the Gulf producers. With that loss, our strategic petroleum reserve is not helpful. Next slide. And so if you look at the current U.S. stockpile, it's gone down from almost $20 billion at one form early, now to 1.6, depending on how you quantify our stockpile. Stockpile used to be managed by FEMA. Now it's being managed by defense. As soon as it was given to defense, defense started selling off the materials because the Cold War was over. This really isn't a threat any longer. I think today we need to relook the importance of a stockpile as one of a number of measures for mitigating vulnerability to overseas supply cutoff and a domination of production facilities by potential domination by China. Next slide. Okay, China is driven by two things, affluence and its need to maintain power because of social instability. The Communist Party is struggling now to meet the needs of people that are not in the large urban areas. Next slide. And so the population growth of India and China, both massive consumers of resources, will continue to drive their economic growth. Next slide. And we should understand how China views the world. If it were the world hegemon, it would be taking action, so the theory goes, to maintain its preeminence. It assumes the United States is doing that. And if you look at our historic use of containment against the Soviet Union and the fact that we're now in alliance with even Vietnam on their southern border, if for what other reason would we possibly be striking a strong economic and political tie with Vietnam, with whom we fought this difficult war? Next slide. So we overproduce, in their eyes, on the defense sector, $500 billion this year, actually, if you include Iraq and Afghanistan, close to $800 billion going to the defense side. Their production of defense matters, even ramped up, is less than $100 billion, depending on your most generous offers. These are some other issues that they've struggled with. Why, if we control the Bretton Woods Accord institutions, and we mean for them to be out there to encourage the world's development as a whole, would we send the former Deputy Secretary of Defense to be the head of the World Bank? Or would we say that one of our strategically guided munitions that can literally fly down smokestacks while television's watching in the Iraq war would mistakenly hit their embassy in Belgrade in 2000? Next slide, please. I'm not saying this is necessarily manipulation on the part of the United States. I am saying that many people consider it something of a questionable state and one that needs to be considered. China's demand on the left in gray on the top, and their domestic supplies in yellow also on the top, and the shortfall underneath. As Dr. Menzies said, the Chinese are consuming increasing quantities of the minerals they produce and are reducing their exports as a result. Next slide. So China's mineral dilemma, well, I think you've covered that pretty well, Dr. Menzies. The key position here is that by 2020, their proven reserves will have dropped to about six minerals. Next slide. And so they are driven by a minerals policy that they can't avoid. They need to acquire access to the minerals. They have a very well integrated program for making that acceptable and positive. They ask only that you vote against Taiwan and the United Nations and you don't go along with Taiwanese independence. Other than that, transparency, human rights fall by the wayside. Economics comes first, and as they would say, we want to respect the internal politics of other states. That's not how the United States approaches it. And they're backed by substantial amounts of resources. Next slide. So this is a whole-of-government approach practiced by the Chinese with something the U.S. lacks, and that is foreign assistance dollars. First thing that gets cut in the United States is foreign assistance simply because we Americans don't know much about foreign affairs. And so the Chinese don't have that worry, and they have almost unlimited money, next slide, please, to throw at the problem. For example, two years ago, they put $200 billion into the China Investment Corporation, which spent $3 billion for a seat on the board of Blackstone, which interceded for the China Development Bank with Barclays, where China invested $7 billion to give them the advice and influence of Barclays Bank, which is the most influential bank across Africa, in its efforts to approach resource access in Africa in a more sophisticated style. Next slide, please. So if we also look at the problems associated with Africa, the minerals storehouse, you'll see that food security is an issue. And if China is already beginning to talk about using Africa as a breadbasket for its own import needs, positive. Next slide, please. So this is just a slide to throw some of the figures out. China purchases those percents and has driven up price, as you can see at the bottom, substantially. In fact, in 2001, the price of copper was 72 cents a pound on the world market. Before the fall last April, it was up to $3.94 a pound, which is over 500% increase, almost all of it driven by the rapacious consumption of the Chinese economy. Next slide. Next slide. Okay, China's other mineral partners are also important because it gives them a substantial amount of influence with these mineral producers. Next slide. Australia in particular, U.S. ally, is increasingly dependent on China as a purchaser, as a source of foreign exchange and purchaser of their minerals. It's already changed the political position of the Australians toward many issues such as political immigration from China into Australia and China's imports to the U.S. Recognize these could be cut off simply because China is consuming them at a greater rate every year as their economy will return to growing at 10 to 12% a year after this brief hiatus in the 6 to 8% range. Next slide, please. Okay, do we approach this from a win-win situation, or is it going to be a zero-sum game? Next slide. There are many areas of cooperation that are out there, not the least of which is reasonable raw material prices. I don't mean to suggest that we have a Cold War enemy. Next slide. But it is time, I believe, for us to begin looking at resource policy and re-examine, because of Chinese impact on the world economy and its own acquisition policies of wanting to own the source of the minerals, to look at how we can use these three elements of power, as Ms. Clinton has characterized them, to improve the national security of the United States. Next slide. So in conclusion, I would say that the first thing we need to do is develop a plan for national strategic and critical resources, strategic reflecting its essential impact on the U.S. economy, critical tending to be restricted, depending on the definition, to defense matters. We need to revitalize the national defense stockpile and not make it the only thought that we consider in terms of mitigating import vulnerability. We should include strategic minerals as a vital interest in our new national security strategy, make it a priority for the national defense strategy and the quadrennial defense review, get Department of Defense more aware of these issues, make it a salient objective of diplomacy and development. Because much the same as the Chinese practice development as a tool of foreign policy, we should make our mineral dependencies around the world on a handful of producing states an important diplomatic priority. And we should also mount a strategic communications message effort to the American people so that they are more aware and Congress is more aware of the criticality of the situation. And we should also use the climate change focus to draw attention back to the importance for recycling, resubstitution, reuse, alternatives to the minerals on which we are critically dependent. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Buss. That was a fascinating and very information-filled presentation. Our final speaker is Mr. Sipo Nurmi. He's the Deputy Head of Trade Section at the Delegation of the European Commission in Washington, D.C. Prior to his assignment, he worked at the U.S. desks of External Trade and External Relations Directorates of the General and Enlargement Directorate General of the European Commission. Before joining the European Commission, he worked as a researcher, an attorney at law specializing in international commerce law. He holds master's degrees in law from the University of Helsinki and European law from the College of Europe in Bruges. I'm also fascinated to find out that the EU has come up with a strategy, at least, or a plan to deal with these issues, so we'll see what their approach has been as contrast with our suggestions. Mr. Nurmi?
Thank you very much, and good afternoon to everybody. The European Commission is not a defense, or it doesn't have competence in defense or defense policy. But of course, our economic policy is ultimately important for the strategic and defense issues as well. So I think it's a little bit of a broader approach, but still, it has a very important consequences on the issues you have discussed previously at this event. To introduce our approach, we have an a long-term competitiveness agenda to improve competitiveness in the European Union, and it became a reality that undistorted access to raw materials can be a very important factor that would hamper our improved competitiveness. And as mentioned by the previous speakers, there has been a lot of attention paid to access to energy and energy prices, and minerals were left a little bit at south, so there was a feeling that something had to be done on the minerals side as well. Externally, EU is very dependent on imports of strategically important raw materials, and those raw materials are more and more affected by market distortions. And internally, exploration and extraction of minerals within the EU is facing increased competition for different land uses and a highly regulated environment. So there was a need to have an integrated response, and the European Union Council tasked the Commission in May 2007 to come up with a plan to address these issues. Now, on the analysis of the supply and demand side of minerals, it's much the same as with the United States. Traditionally, the European member states have been self-sufficient or even exporters of strategic minerals, but now the EU has moved to a high import dependence. And there's also, with the with the growth of economies, there is more and more need for primary and secondary raw materials. And certain materials are particularly critical. And while the effects of the current financial crisis are leading in the slowdown of the growth of global demand for raw materials, it is expected that the demand will rise again once this slowdown is over. And there are more and more measures by the producing countries to put obstacles to the exploitation of these critical minerals. And those obstacles are not likely to be disappear with the rise of the prices and improved economy. And there are now also there are fundamental changes on global markets. There are more than 450 export, according to our information, there are more than 450 export restrictions on more than 400 different raw materials. And there are more and more strategies by different producers to secure privileged access to raw materials. And 50% of major reserves are located in low-income countries. So the Commission proposed then a strategy which is based on three different or separate pillars. The first pillar is about ensuring access to raw materials from international markets under the same conditions and as other industrial competitors. The second is to set right framework conditions within the EU in order to foster a sustainable supply of raw materials from European sources. And the third pillar is to boost overall resource efficiency and promote recycling to reduce the EU's consumption of primary raw materials and decrease the relative import dependence. So the first pillar is the external dimension of the issue. The second is rather what we do inside the EU. And the third is some kind of a hybrid, or it's more about the recycling and reuse of materials. And to start with the concrete actions, we first have to define what are the critical raw materials. And that will be identified in a close cooperation with member states and stakeholders. The Commission had listed the most likely critical materials in their communication. I'm not going to read it out, but it's more or less what has been in the previous slides. And then when we go to these different pillars, for the first pillar on the external dimension of the mineral strategy, we first have to ensure better and more effective coordination and coherence among EU external policies at various levels, for example, with the management of our strategic partnerships and policy dialogues with third countries, in particular with Africa emerging economies, and that means that we have different policies towards Africa emerging economies and developed countries. And second, we have to promote enhanced international cooperation in organizations such as OECD, UNCTAD, and World Bank. And there are lots of other more specific dialogues where the coordination is also important. For example, on Arctic deep sea mining and international trade routes. There are more details on this in our communication. And then we also have to include provisions on raw materials in trade agreements. We should include as appropriate provisions on access to and sustainable management of raw materials in bilateral and multilateral trade agreements and regulatory dialogues. Now, these issues have been mentioned also in the previous presentations, and I just would like to raise one issue that's and this is a little bit off my script from the headquarters, but what I have experienced in my past jobs, that there is a very sensitive discussion about how much we can impose on our trade partners certain other provisions, for example, respect of human rights, because we have in our cooperation agreement so-called standard clauses, and some of the clauses include the partner must respect some basic human rights. And then we may have a situation when that partner country is negotiating at the same time with other countries which are less interested in including this kind of human rights provisions in the agreement. So there's a question of where to strike the balance. How much do we want to impose certain standard clauses which may be disadvantageous to us in an economic terms. But I don't think there is any gold standard or there is no easy way out. It's almost always a case-by-case, on a case-by-case basis. Then we also need to, on the external side, we need to address all distortion measures by all available instrument. That means by negotiations on new rules within the World Trade Organizations. And we have to use vigorously the existing rules and ensure enforcement by the dispute settlement system within the WTO. And we have so-called market access partnerships with certain countries. And there we also have to see that we vigorously enforce our the commitments are vigorously enforced. And we also have to then prioritize. Certain distortive measures are much more important than others, so we have to see where we want to put our efforts and our resources. And it was mentioned that there is a strong concentration on iron transport of iron ore. That's also an example that it's not only about rules between the states, but competition rules are also can be very important, because it's not only that certain countries have a high there's a high concentration of certain minerals in certain countries, but there can be also that very few companies are dealing. They control the minerals, so competition rules may become relevant as well. And to continue on under this first external pillar, we also have to address this in our development policy, and we have to help to strengthen the states that are important producers of these minerals. To help them with capacity building so that they become themselves more stable and easier for example, mining companies to operate in. And that actually means that we have to promote a sound investment climate in some of these countries. And then if I go to the second pillar, which is about our actions within the EU. We have to improve the regulatory framework related to access to land. So we have to exchange best practices in the area of land use planning and administrative conditions for exploration and extraction. we have to increase the involvement of national geological surveys in land use planning within the member states and develop a strategy for integrating subsurface components into land planning. And finally, we have to develop guidelines on reconciling extraction activities in or near Natura 2000 areas with environmental protection. Now, these things are mentioned in our communication, and it says in the communication that these guidelines about reconciling these economic and environmental issues, that those guidelines would be finalized by the end of 2008, but it has not been so swift. So we expect there is a special working group dealing with those, preparing those guidelines. And now it is expected that those guidelines would be ready in 2010. And we also have to encourage a better networking between national geological surveys to increase EU's knowledge base. Because, of course, as a big difference, we are not like the United States. These things are still very much the responsibility of the member states, and we need to improve our internal networking so everybody knows where we are going. And this goes also to the improvement of the knowledge base of mineral deposits within the EU, and with the view that we have a facilitated exchange of information and we have a better interoperability and dissemination of data. And then on the economic side, too, that we look into how we can improve the access of SMEs into these activities. And also under this second pillar, we have to promote skills and research within the EU. We are planning to create partnerships between universities, geological surveys, and industry. And there should be promotion of research on innovative exploration and extraction technologies, recycling, materials substitution, and resource efficiency. And then we go to the third pillar, which is about recycling. There we try to increase resource efficiency and foster substitution of raw materials. That by giving impetus to resource efficiency and eco-innovative production processes. And we have already a plan called Action Plan on Sustainable Consumption and Production and Sustainable Industrial Policy, and that will be then updated to take into account these strategic minerals. And also to promote research projects on resource-efficient products and production and development substitutes. And finally, we want to promote recycling and facilitate the use of secondary raw materials. And to that end, the Commission and the Member States should ensure a sound and harmonized enforcement of the waste shipment regulation, release and release information on illegal shipment flows. And we also want to encourage recycling markets through the following measures: legislation, standards and labeling, public procurement, financing, and finally knowledge sharing and international action. That's more or less the outline of the plan we presented to the European Council at the end of last year. And now we will report in 2 years back to the European Council on its implementation. And we have set an ad hoc working group which consists of officials from the European Commission, from the member states, from the producers, mining companies, and also from the users of the minerals. And they had their first meeting now a couple of 2 weeks ago, April 30, and they started working on the methodology and the ways how to define which will be the final list of critical raw materials. And the next meeting will be in the fall this year. And as I said, we will then report back to the working group should finish its work by end of 2010. In conclusion, I would just say that this is a new approach on the EU level But some member states like Germany, United Kingdom, and Austria and France have already had similar, or they have experience in looking at these different issues together at the national level. And the practical work indeed is going to be carried out by the ad hoc working group. And the work that we have been done so far in the Commission, it has taken into account the 2008 U.S. report by the National Research Council. So we look forward to also to working with the American government and American stakeholders on this initiative. We haven't had any concrete suggestions yet what we should do with the U.S. government, but given our respective situations and our strategic interest, I think there's a lot of scope for cooperation. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Nurmi. Referring back to what Janer said at the beginning about developing some recommendations, I can think of a whole bunch of recommendations right off the top of my head for the U.S. government. It seems that, of course, that our European allies are a little bit further down the road on developing a policy to actually address a lot of these issues that we've heard about today. In fact, this is sort of a question to our panel. To what degree, if any, has the U.S. government actually begun to develop a coherent policy approach towards dealing with a lot of the issues associated with the strategic minerals access that we've heard about today? And secondly, I'd like to make another observation and also formulate that as a question. Traditionally, the U.S. and our European allies have operated on the free market system, you know, globalization, free market economy, best price, best practices type of approach. Whereas it seems that, of course, the Russians and the Chinese have an entirely different approach to their economic policy. And based on what was said earlier, that about 50% of the raw materials that we are concerned about are in underdeveloped or in countries that are, quote, underdeveloped around the world, who also have more statist approaches to these issues. I'm curious that it seems to me there's a sort of inherent conflict between our free market globalization approach, which is sort of, you know, this is economics and we'll, you know, deal with it on an economic basis, and holding off things like, you know, human rights and those issues on for political discussions, whereas the Chinese, for example, of course, tend to regard this as an issue of state national interest, and their national interest is access to raw materials, and we'll discuss human rights next year. So there's very definitely a significantly different approach between the U.S. and our European allies to what's being done by Russia and China in dealing with the third world countries that also have very statist approaches. I'm just sort of curious, how would you see us addressing that particular problem? Mr. Butts, for example?
There's always been tension over our approach to foreign policy, but we're a democratic state and we have values, and if we attach ourselves to those values and we're consistent in applying them year after year, then we gain the respect of many people who yearn to be free. So I think it's important for us to find every alternative to supporting a dictatorship or a human rights abuser. But that means that in addition to depending on the free market, we recognize vulnerabilities that come with that dependence and do what we can to change the policies of a heavy-handed dictator, for example, and take measures to reduce the vulnerability, such as substitution, alternatives, new technologies, encouraging the private sector to maintain greater supplies or stocks, making sure that we understand where we're vulnerable, working with allies that may have alternative sources of supply. But I would say that this is a tension that's always been there and will always be as long as we're founded on the principles that we have.
Mr. Lindsay?
The Japanese and the Koreans have a little different approach than either the Chinese or ourselves. And the Japanese have something called the Japan Oil and Gas Corporation, which also contains their minerals group. And in the past, the way the Japanese have handled access to minerals, they're completely import-dependent for everything. But what they've done is they've used investment in third world countries in terms of mineral exploration through these national corporations, but then the understanding is that a Japanese corporation will have an opportunity to develop the material when it's if it's found and eventually goes into operation. Usually, what happens is one of the big Japanese firms like Sumitomo or Dowa Minerals will take a minority position in the company that eventually controls the property, and maybe have a 30% stake and will take an offtake of that proportion of the minerals. So they've used an organization of a public organization basically to act in part as a feeder of projects to their own private companies. So there may be other types of arrangements that don't purely fall into relying only on the market or relying government actions completely.
Roman, comments?
Last week, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev signed the latest national security strategy of Russia. It's a fascinating document when you look at it because it has a rather apocalyptic view of the fight, the coming battle for resources in the world as a military question today. This reflects the thinking not merely of Medvedev and Putin, but I think basically of the entire Russian political elite, that the future fight is going to be over for natural resources. For the Russians, of course, it's above all oil and gas, but they see this in a broader worldwide view. This is their assessment, their fears, their anxieties over what is happening and where Russian national interests lie. So when we take it to the question of strategic minerals, this obviously is a very extremely important part of their whole national security strategy. The list of the Russian list of strategic minerals that was published a number of years ago is a good example of this. This questions of resource nationalism, the semi-private nature of Russian businesses, Gazprom, Norilsk Nickel, and others that might be in some way looked at as private companies, in fact, they're pretty tightly controlled. I don't have an answer to your questions, but I'm seeing that in the way the Russians are behaving, and it's a bit different from the Chinese, of course, and way different, as Dr. Menzi said, from the Japanese. But their approach is becoming much more heavy-handed, I think. And I think we're going to see that in the next decade. Will they encourage, will they support the destruction, for example, of Zimbabwe? Is it a failed state, and is Mugabe trying to gain Russian and Chinese backing to keep himself or his appointed predecessors in power? Will they stand for it, or is it in their interest to see a country like Zimbabwe be destabilized internally, vulnerable, and keeping the United States on its toes? I don't know, but I think it's a consideration we have to look at.
Janusz, you have any thoughts?
Not here to learn.
Okay. Zinovich?
Yeah, just wanted to quickly say that our strategy is really based on basically the principles of free economy and so to say use of our different instruments of soft power, and it's also beyond the this kind of a more defense and strategic issues than they are beyond the remit of the European Commission. Thank you.
And?
sorry, I wanted to go back to Dr. Menzies' overview of the history and note that we're probably on the lower side of interest on this right now, but understanding that this is potentially a real crisis. So I'd ask to, like, both our U.S. and our European colleagues, are there any particular parliamentarians, say, in the EU or that you all know of in our Congress that are aware of this or championing this, somebody like a Luger or, you know, who we might work with to raise this profile?
I can't really tell you who in Congress. We do get requests for information about particular issues from congressional offices from time to time regarding there was one about rare earths about 3 weeks ago. But they tend to be very transitory. Usually those are handed out to, you know, junior staff, and it's not really captured the attention of the senior policy staff, I would say. Now, I would say that it's very clear that the House Committee, the Committee on Armed Services, they were the ones that intervened to get the report done by the NRC. They played a significant role in that because they saw the fall in the defense stockpile and were concerned that that needed to be thought about before the last $1.5 billion dollars worth of materials were sold off. Defense has actually groups underway working on the recommendations from that report. They have working groups out there, but defense tends to be very particular, and they have their own kind of ways of planning that are pretty detailed. And so I don't think it's really risen to the same level in terms of the economy. Certainly the National Academy report on the economy was laid out the problems very well of the nature. But there's not a place that you go in the U.S. government that deals with minerals policy. we are in the Interior Department. The USGS is in the Interior Department. The Interior Department, it's really a vestige in many ways because most of the interest in minerals was taken out of Interior back in the late 1970s when the Department of Energy was created. So for the Interior Department, minerals are a very low priority. They have lands to manage and critters to take care of and parks to deal with and Native Americans to deal with. So minerals comes on a pretty low basis. So to an extent, it's a matter of finding, of being able to create a focal point where that kind of information comes forward and it gets to the foreign policy debate. Minerals right now in foreign policy, the places that it's there, the Kimberley Process, the Burma Jade and Rubies Act, those are the places that in terms of the foreign policy community, those are the things that they would know about minerals.
And certainly the SASC and the HASC would be places one would expect an interest in, but it really depends on the Senate staffers and congressional staffers. General Price is gone, and he was a great resource, and he sustained the debate back in the old days. At that time, you had mineral-producing states that were also advocates of stockpiling and keeping domestic production going. And I'd say now we need to look at the private sector to see how much interest they have. Do they feel particularly vulnerable, and to encourage them to come forward and do what they did in the old days, and that was to sponsor roundtables like this to get people focused on those activities, bring in Senate staffers, make sure that the Lugars of the world are well read into it. I hate to say it like this, but we've always been threat-driven. Unless you can go to the American people and say that there's a bogeyman that's waiting for you out there, then it's difficult to sell anything that has to do with foreign affairs. And I think China's openness and aggressiveness with which it's seeking to gain mineral control in the role it's playing now in the major corporations, where it was willing to put $18 billion into Unocal. And the Congress waived that off, and they put about the same amount into, Rio Tinto last year, and also with the Aluminum Corporation of America. So they're beginning to play, and they're playing in a big way. And if they go into Africa, is treated as a breadbasket, where it's easy for them to control the one or two key politicians in a given country that is a monocrop economy country, so to speak, where they only have one or two foreign exchange earning businesses or products, it really gives us, I think, a chance to characterize the vulnerabilities of this for all the free market countries. But in terms of having somebody who's an advocate, unfortunately, I don't know of any. But I think that if touch base with our stockpiling leadership, and because they're fairly aware.
Yes, sir.
If we're talking about resource wars, it occurs to me, as I hear the panelists today, it's very much asymmetrical in terms of how it's being waged, and everybody's touched on that. Roman, you mentioned that to take my example only on the Russian side, that Russia maintains a list of what is 29 or 41 or some number of strategic resources in which the Russian government sharply restricts outside investment, non-Russian investment, right? But the asymmetry comes in when the Russian companies, which are nominally private, are out shopping in the rest of the world but actually have state backing and are sharply limiting. They're using, I would suspect, the same shopping list of minerals that they're restricting at home. So that's the asymmetry. I'm interested in what the panelists would suggest if they were limited to simply one policy prescription each in terms of responding to that. And my thought is, I don't know that we want to become more statist in our approach to even up the sides, but how do you even up the sides in this sort of war?
Mr. Butts, we'll let you lead off and proceed around.
Well, the United States has always been ambivalent at best about an industrial policy. Republicans very much laissez-faire free market. If there's hope for encouraging an industrial policy, it would be under a Democratic regime, and we're fresh, and so that's worth thinking about and hearing your remarks. I would think that given the emphasis at DOD and at State and in Congress of championing a more robust foreign assistance budget to where we put money back into USAID, put money into Department of State so that DOD doesn't have to undertake these development functions, and there's been an active interest. In fact, you can look at the reorganization of USAID and the creation of DACHA, where they wanted to flow in an OFTA disaster response manner development resources for the purpose of preventing failed states that could be used to promote terrorist activities, that you could say that this is a similar type of function. That we're looking at stabilizing key states around the world that are not just potential training areas for terrorists, but are critical to U.S. economic and defense security needs. And we should emphasize those two elements of power, if you will, aid and state, to go after that. And at the same time, where possible, encourage economic development by the private sector, working hand-in-hand, whole of government, because those things are used a lot, and USAID can contribute to that.
I think that one of the key factors in this has to do with investment money. We're not in a real good position with regard to the Chinese vis-a-vis investment money because they have an awful lot of it. And the Russians were doing pretty well, but maybe aren't doing quite so well right now. The Russians in particular have put a lot of mineral deposits off limits to foreign investment. And one wonders why we aren't negotiating similar, access, that there be level access to resources on both sides. I think that's one thing that certainly could be looked at as part of a policy overall. But your leverage with that, a lot of it's going to have to do with how much money is there to be invested. I can't imagine you have very much leverage with the Chinese.
to be very honest, I don't know. It's a very difficult question, Dan. You have other examples. I mean, what do you do when a country like, say, for example, Romania has an ambivalent policy towards some of the mining projects in Romania? It's never clear. Is it a question of corruption at a local level? Is it corruption? Is it corruption at all? Is it a national policy at times to behave one way towards one country and another way to a different country? What can the United States do? Like I said, I honestly don't know. I think the first step is more debates like this, more roundtables, possibly hearings in Congress on these matters, trying to talk to people and bring in people like Mr. Butts and Dr. Menzi, who really understand these things. I think once we can, the awareness is there that this is a problem, then I think we've made a very big first step and see what happens next.
Yeah, I'm very much on the lines with the on the lines of the previous speakers, and I just would think that you can't really go for just one single solution or this kind of one policy choice. I think it's all more or less mix of different policies, and it depends on the country or the market you are talking about. And I think our strategy tries to list this kind of a toolbox where you can look where you can see what kind of a policy options you could have. It's a different situation when we talk about an African nation, or when we talk about Russia. There, the options are quite different.
The microphone.
Thank you very much for wonderful presentations, which covered all dimensions of the problem. As far as today's seminar is called Strategic Minerals, a Transatlantic Priority, I would like to ask a question. In interdependent world, I mean, the power comes actually from kind of asymmetric interdependence, as was mentioned, and about exploiting sensitivity and vulnerability of countries. So what do you think, how do you see possible cooperation between the European Union and United States in joining the efforts and trying to exploit the dependence of, for example, African countries on the markets of these countries? Will the coordination help, and will such coordination of efforts prevent the race to the bottom and jeopardizing the values of Western civilization? Thank you.
Mr. Nermi, lead off on that one.
Yeah, I would hope that the transatlantic cooperation doesn't make it to a race to the bottom. I think we have quite similar, almost identical interests. And for us, I mentioned in my presentation what we think of the transatlantic cooperation. We think there's a lot of scope for cooperation, but we would need to have somebody from the U.S. government to tell. It's a little bit too early to do cooperation. It would be a monologue. So I think we have to wait that we have our counterparts in place as well. But I think there's a lot of scope in international organizations, in trade rules, and many other, and in development policy. And, of course, then in security and defense policy, which is then, again, outside my responsibility.
Could I ask a follow-up on that? Do you think there's any merit now, before you have a counterpart here in the United States, for an association concept where you might say, for example, we need to focus on Africa because we have forced migration that's sending people spilling over into Europe. This isn't good for either of the countries. We need to focus more on development there and let strategic minerals be a weighting concept that would add weight to prioritizing the countries so that we could begin work on that sort of thing, either combating terrorism or forced migration or climate change instability?
I don't see any problem. I think, a problem with that. I think it's rather a question of getting organized. because this is, from our side, we have an official policy to take these issues into account in our different policies, in development policy and so forth. For example, if we talk about development policy and our actions in Africa, it's just a question of introducing this point to the meeting agendas. Our colleagues meet regularly, so I think it's rather a question of getting organized.
Hi, my name is Richard Young, and I work for a mining company. And this is a really urgent issue because the mining industry takes a lot of time. It's a very difficult business. We've just gone through this incredible metals boom, and there's been tens of billion dollars spent on exploration around the world and really hasn't discovered much. I work for a mining company, and we got most of the exploration dollars, and I think that if you talk to the major mining companies, there have been virtually no world-class discoveries made in the last 5 years. You talk to the base metal guys, and there hasn't been anything discovered for 20 years. And, you know, even if whether it's the EU or the U.S. put a policy in place that focuses on exploration, you're 7 to 10 years before you start to see some of the benefit of that. It's a very tough business, minerals extraction, and even when you look at the world's supply, a lot of what is left is problematic. It's you know, mining companies and countries are producing what is accessible and they've got the technology for, but as we start to move further into this decade, what you're seeing is some of the reserves they've got on their books are more problematic and they may not be able to extract those. And unlike the oil and gas sector, where you know you've got, it's so big that technology changes, for hard rock mining, there just really hasn't been much of that. I mean, I think that you know you may be looking 30 or 40 years ago since the last major improvement, some of the hard rock technologies. So we've made improvements at the margins, but nothing that has dramatically changed the extraction process.
What kind of encouragement would the private sector need to go out and try and diversify and develop new deposits?
The sector is certainly doing everything it can to do that, but it's just exploration is less than a zero-sum game. So if you invest $10 billion, generally, you know, you get $5 billion of value. So it's largely been in the junior exploration end where the discoveries historically have been made. It's essentially mad money where, you know, you invest in 10 stocks and maybe one of them works out, and the one that does work out, it does well. But the senior mining companies have been consolidating in part because they're ex-growth. And it's really problematic. And you've got some of the best people in these companies, and they cannot replace reserves. And I'm not sure what to say. It's really tough. And I think that as we look out over the next 20 or 30 years, it will be more challenging than it is today. So events like this are critical to trying to turn the corner on that.
If I may comment on that, I just received my latest edition of The Economist magazine, which has the lead article about deep sea mining and law of the sea and the new efforts to develop the undersea resources, which could be fantastic, but they're several years off before we get the technology. And also, as you pointed out, you know, you need money. And frankly, it's a very high-risk proposition. And where the EU might have come up with a policy to support or at least encourage explorations on that area, and I'd be curious to hear what the EU has to say about the Arctic area, for example, and the deep-sea resource law, the sea activity. But thus far, I haven't indicated, as we've commented on, there's been a notable lack of interest on the part of the U.S. government. And while I understand the private sector point of view, frankly, is, you know, you have to make money. And if you can't make money, you don't do it. So there's a serious lack of something on the American side, I think, to try and get the U.S. government more focused on it. Maybe we can use some of these stimulus funds to stimulate some activity in that area. Mr. Newman?
Just want to say that support to research and science is part of our strategy. And now we have this 7th framework program that basically covers all RTD under the European Union. And it will also have some sort of a priority to address this address innovative exploration technologies onshore and offshore. And just as a general remark on this seventh framework program, that it's a bottom to top approach. So companies and associations have to present a project, and then it will be vetted by the competent authorities. And with all this kind of a policy support, I think there is a serious chance that you could get support on this. Of course, you have to have European companies and associations applying for it. And that might be also a potential point for cooperation with the United States, because we have had now preliminary talks about energy and innovations in the energy sector, where we might be able to organize cooperation project, not necessarily joint projects, but at least the projects would be coordinated, and the American partners would get the money from the U.S. government, and the European partners would get it from the European Commission.
In line with what you said, are African mines that mine the strategic minerals, who are they owned by? Is it private industry, or is it mostly state controlled?
A lot of the African mines at this point are owned by private concerns. I mean, that South Africa is largely a private owned by private facilities. If you look at the Copper Belt, which is the source of a lot of the cobalt, it's not exclusively, but there are a lot of private companies in there, including Chinese, Indian companies, U.S. companies, Canadian. In Africa, you don't see a lot of successful state mining companies. That went on in the 1970s, and because of their need for revenue, they tended not to put the money back into the enterprises, and basically they bankrupted them. They went through a major period of privatization of those resources in the 1990s. So they've pretty much gotten out of the business of state control of the companies. I think the thing that you see more of going on in Africa, at least until about a year ago when prices were going up, was almost every new government was re-examining all of the contracts. And I think that while certainly some of the contracts were probably signed by governments that maybe weren't maybe hadn't had broad interests when they signed them, I think when you start renegotiating contracts wholesale, you introduce other possible problems, and that became very popular. In Latin America, it's been just a little bit different. Instead of renegotiating the contracts, they've tended to seek higher royalties when prices were up, and that's most of the companies are willing to negotiate on that or in local investment. But when the contract becomes an issue, that's a real problem for the private companies.
Questions? We'll alternate between our two here. Dan, you're next.
Looking at the fact that we're having a kind of transatlantic focus here, and I'm wondering if this is truly strategic, and I think we agree that it is, would there be a place for NATO, which has at least, you know, you have the U.S., the Canadians, you have a number of nations in on the continental European side, which are active in the resource area, and I know it's not enough to take care of, I know it's not in Africa in aggregate or anything like that, but is a place to start, would it be a place to start for NATO itself to establish some sort of focus on how one might address and rank these relative strategic minerals and perhaps act as a bit of an ombudsman relative to members to see if they could work through issues that are slowing development, or I don't know what these forms would take, but Maybe NATO could appoint a czar. That's as close as we want to get to Russifying NATO, but we have so many czars these days here. Maybe we could appoint somebody to take this on. I mean, we have a little bit of this when it comes to Nabucco and so on, trying to make sure that we push these things forward. We don't have anything. There's no there. There's no place for these issues to go, and I'm wondering if we couldn't try to put something around it. Does that make sense, or is that just another talking shop that...
I'll refer to our EC colleague over here to address that issue.
Yeah, well, this is rather my own private view. I think NATO surely talks about these things. It is too important not to be on the agenda. How far this? But then one has to, when we talk about economic initiatives and strategies, that, at least for us, it's rather on the EC side. You cannot really... NATO is... It's not really at the same. It's different. They have different competencies or areas of responsibility. And then we still have member states that are not members of NATO. So that also complicates the picture. And on our side, it's further complicated that we have different levels of authority or power. Certain things are still under the responsibility of member states. Certain things are exclusively for us. So it makes it a little... It's you have to... Rather, you must have some sort of overall strategy and then see who are the right players to discuss it. But I don't... My personal view would be that it would be difficult to put it as like some sort of an overall responsibility for NATO because of the different competencies and also the fact that all EC member states, EU member states, are not members of NATO.
Sir, in the back, just one.
I'm John DeYoung with the U.S. Geological Survey, and you asked a question, earlier question was asked, about the extent to which the United States government has addressed minerals issues. And we've heard a lot about it today in some of the history we've gone over. And if you would, all bear with me, I'd like to just fill in a couple of the blanks in between those. Certainly the introduction of Charles Kenneth Leith is a very important one. If you read some of Leith's papers in the 30s and 40s, even back in the 20s, about this, you find that he had a lot of insight that really reads very well today on mineral policy. After World War II, Senator Malone from Nevada conducted extensive hearings, and there are volumes on these committee prints from the Malone hearings on the U.S. mineral position, and that followed with the Paley Commission, which is another government effort on this, and then the Boyd Commission, with James Boyd, later became the director of the Bureau of Mines, and about that time, the Mining and Materials Policy Act of 1970 was passed. So there's a piece of legislation that states what the U.S. position is on mineral policy. Requires a report from the Secretary of Interior on the state of the U.S. minerals industry to be delivered to the President annually. In 1976, the EADS Commission, the National Commission on Supplies and Shortages, was commissioned by the federal government, addressing the minerals issues of that time. And then in 1978-79, the President's Policy Coordinating Committee for Mineral Policy, and boy, the reports from that commission are really gray literature, but there is a Volume 3 of that report, which we referred to as the Vogley Volume, which was a contract given to the Pennsylvania State University that categorized all the recommendations from all those previous commissions into the topics for that commission, which would be land use, finance, security of foreign supply, foreign policy. 1980, I guess, is when the first assault in the resource war was fired. Admiral Mott, I know, was the original resource warrior. And at that time, Congress passed the National Minerals and Materials Policy and Research Development Act in 1980. And that's important for us in the USGS because that's the act that, if you notice, the W started appearing in Minerals Yearbook at that time because it required us to withhold individual company proprietary data. And that resulted in a statement of mineral policy by President Reagan. And I'm searching for the date on that. It was either 81 or 83, which was really the impetus for our International Strategic Minerals Inventory effort, which was a six-country effort that did a series of reports on the status of supply of minerals, and the first thing we did was start to discuss what we meant by strategic. The Germans said, I know that you in the United States and Canada, you consider like cobalt and chromium, things like that strategic, but for us in Germany, we consider like copper, lead, and zinc to be strategic. And the South Africans chimed in and said, well, what's strategic for us is what we produce, because it's important for our economy that we get the income from this, so we consider chromium important because and strategic because we produce it. Alan Archer, one of the British representatives, said, well, what is more, he wrote this in a paper, what is more strategic, the cobalt in the jet engine or the aggregate in the runway? The U.S. Bureau of Mines held the first annual National Mineral Policy Conference around 1989. T.S. Airy was director, and you know Mr. Airy passed away, I think, 2 weeks ago. I've always said myself, it's really dangerous to name anything first annual. And I don't think there ever was a second annual, if you look for that. I look back at some of the developments that happened over these things. Congress, I guess, really took an action that defined mineral policy in 1996 when they closed the U.S. Bureau of Mines. Kept parts of it, but there's a lot of things that are just gone. And I know we at the USGS spent a lot of time when there'd be a call for something the Bureau of Mines had did, and they'd say, well, I'll call Dave Menzies or call John DeYoung, and I try to explain what part of gone, don't you understand, that the Congress didn't save your money by taking every part of the Bureau of Mines and transferring it to another federal agency. A lot of it was gone. Probably 80% of it was gone. During the discussions over this, there was a story that I'll recount where Japanese visitors were asking about what the particular people like Dr. John Morgan at the Bureau of Mines, what's your interest in strategic minerals? How'd you get interested in it? He said, well, actually, it had a lot to do with you. I said, really? Yeah. You know, we noticed when you needed coal, you went into Manchuria. When you needed tin, you went into Thailand. When you needed rubber, you know, you went into Malaysia. But you know what you really did that got our attention on strategic minerals? And they said, no, what? You dropped bombs on Pearl Harbor. So, you know, it is the crisis. That whoever said that, they were crisis-driven. It is the, you know, all those other things were, yeah, we're kind of interested in this, but all of a sudden when something like that happens, you have to act. So that adds nothing to the very good insights that have been offered on the changes now and the changes that are needed to the current situation, but probably being armed by looking at the past pretty carefully on what was done before, and I know from some of these things I've walked away from them with a feeling of, wow, we spent a lot of time on that, and you know, most of these things here probably aren't even remembered by folks here.
Janusz?
I just have, maybe it's a simple but very general question. I mean, do we need something like a minerals charter, something along the lines of an energy charter that maybe something else that Russia cannot apply? But in other words, to ensure secure supplies, to prevent monopolization, some basic principles that we can work on, not only with our partners in Europe, but with Japan, other countries that are very much dependent on some of these minerals. It's just a thought. I haven't sort of thought it through.
I think that in terms of coordination, there could be a lot of different mechanisms, and there are obviously a lot of possible ways of coordinating between ourselves and the Europeans, and especially it could be very productive in terms of regional development of some of these countries that have very little besides their minerals, and minerals is a good way to start an economy, maybe not to continue it, but to get things started. But I think in the United States, there is no focus. there is not an Department of Energy. And a story that John didn't tell that I thought maybe he was going to was he was on one of those, the staffs of one of those commissions back in 1979, and they were asked to look at a whole series of things, including revenue. And it was an interagency group, so as soon as the revenue question came up, Treasury says, well, we're not worried about minerals with revenue. We're in charge of revenue, and minerals will just get taken care of. And then minerals and foreign policy came up, and the State Department says, no, look, we're in charge of foreign policy. You know, we're not changing our foreign policy based on minerals. And I think finally the last thing that was left, and the Interior Department had a lead in this, I think the last thing that was left to them was land use, and they had to share that with agriculture.
Let me hold my comment and see if there's time after your question.
I just wanted to ask you, you said that the prices increased like 30% on some of the minerals. How much of it is just pure supply and demand driven, and how much of it is speculation driven? And what is the characteristics of this market? If it's oligopolic, what is the price behind the price formation? Is it political? Is it just purely supply and demand? Thank you.
The markets are very individual. A mineral like copper or most of the base metals are traded daily. There has been more investment money, if you will, gone into minerals. So there are now funds that invest, and I think it's debatable to what extent speculation has played a role in that. But you know, certainly it's that's been debated for oil, and probably for some of the minerals could also be. Other minerals like iron ore are done on a yearly contract, and so that's negotiated, and it's usually negotiated with a lead company and a lead country. And the companies have lots and lots of pricing power, and they've been quite willing to use that over the last 5 years. So it varies from commodity to commodity. But to the extent that consolidation continues to be the way that companies grow their reserves, you're having fewer and fewer companies that are doing the providing. And that I think could be a problem. It's because they clearly in iron ore there's been real effects. I don't think you could necessarily show those same effects in other metals, but certainly there are pretty high levels of concentration that would have resulted if the BHP Rio Tinto merger had gone through. There would have been certainly a lot more concentration in copper and nickel and I think uranium, but there was a lot of speculation about that.
I think CSIS is onto something here, and your leadership is, I believe, important in this area. If you look at smart power, you know, melding soft and hard power together, you took the lead in that. Your report's well-respected and cited around. If you look at CNA's effort to address climate change, they brought 11 three- and four-star generals together to take on what was a fairly esoteric and the military is looking at this topic and turned it into climate change and security, heavy emphasis on the adaptation importance, things that were important to the military. It was a watershed in getting people's attention on climate change around town. So you have opportunities. What if NATO were to host a conference and say we would like to bring our allies from across the pond to focus on this issue? It forces DOD to Ash Carter, a new appointee, who has a background in broad background in security, not just acquisition, to put someone involved, not just the stockpiling group, to look at it. So there are ways, I think, of drawing attention to this with the objective of getting someone at the National Security Council tagged for following this issue, and maybe a sub-PCC at a minimum growing out of this that would allow for greater focus. And saving scarce resources like USGS. You know, it takes nothing to think in terms of consolidating government to a point where USGS would be further reduced. And when you have a mineral information group there that provides that assessment, how do you strengthen that and protect it and to make sure that sort of emphasis is given? And where's the intelligence community on this? So I would think that some key conferences, workshops, follow the Leith approach he used to, in addition to writing articles for Foreign Affairs, attend every conference he could to get the vision out, to get the message out. And so there are ways to go about it. A little strategic planning session, I think, held by your group here might be a way to identify who might be the key players over on the Senate staffs and who are the potential winners. If Stavridis is taking over at NATO as the supreme allied commander and he has an interest in regional stability, where could that be championed? So I just wanted to be positive and encouraging on an important topic.
I'd like to make one observation at the end. I came down because my daughter invited me, and I'm Paul Telleke, and 25 years ago, similar to this article in The Economist, we went to NATO. We produced a book because there was that interest in marine minerals, because that was the Cold War, number one. Number two was that there was no follow-up because this was published in 85. By 89, it was not really critical anymore, so I want to underline that. Secondly, however, NATO is a proper mechanism, I think, and it was even then. I would encourage to follow this lead up. But the crisis part is also critical, obviously. The other observation I want to do, not as a former marine geologist, is that, but 15 years in Russia and CIS countries is partly an investment, partly as advisor to governments, is that Russia is different from China. And Russia is terribly different than China because of two things. One is that, one is the political situation where what's called the Siloviki, the people who are around Putin are fighting it out for the companies that Yeltsin gave away to his cronies. So there's a renationalization, step by step. An example right now was the Rusal-Norilsk nickel situation where the oligarchs, specifically Oleg Deripaska, who is Rusal, and Vladimir Potanin, who is Norilsk, have been at each other's throat for some time trying to get control of these companies. Now, they are trying to do, so they went to Putin, they managed in March, or February actually, to eliminate the export duties on these commodities, just two oligarchs. But the fight is still on. And why is there a fight? Because both companies are in terrible indebted situation. What the oligarchs have done is they borrowed from Alpha Bank and Sberbank and from the rest of the banks against their holdings, and they bought up the shares of the worker shares that were originally were held. Now the value of the companies have shrunk to about a quarter. So did the commodity prices. So, yes, the government wants them to expand abroad and acquire resources similar to like Gazprom's attempts at controlling the pipelines, controlling, the gas storage places in Eastern Europe. Because, for instance, like VSMPO is one of the largest titanium producer, has contracts with Boeing, has contract, just signed a contract with Airbus. To produce airplane parts, but they don't have titanium. They have to import it. So they are going to go after their own titanium resources abroad. But, you see, it's such a murky situation that even though Medvedev would say, yes, we have a policy, Medvedev is really a weak person still in the government because it is Putin's henchmen they're controlling. So Putin's plan is to renationalize some of these companies. So right now, 30% of Norilsk, due to a repayment of those debts, is in government hands through loans from the government. So I think there's more to this situation than anyway, that's all I wanted to say to the topic.
Any other questions? Well, we've come to the closing time that we had promised. I want to sincerely thank our panel for their excellent presentations on the subjects that we've all learned a lot today. So, again, thank you very much, gentlemen.
And
dare I say, a rich vein of material. We'll get back to you at some point as we begin to explore and mine this and try and figure out what we're going to do next.